This version of the podcast is mixed in mono, but if you would like to listen in 5.1 surround sound, please visit ufocast.co.uk/prisoner for more details.
This is episode 10, but we recorded it 8th, back in March 2022. Welcome to the latest episode of By Hook or By Crook, which is still what we've called our podcast, where we take a nice wander through, well, The Prisoner, in any order we care to go for it. But, you know, that's it. So, I'm Michael, host of the Tin Dog Podcast, but here where I am A, number two, and my fellow number two is...
Luke, formerly of Smudwip. I don't know why I bring that up. Because I haven't done it for years. Yes,
UFO, I mean, yes,
predominantly the host of the UFO Cast, which is where this podcast will be. It will be going out on the same feed as that, as well as its own separate feed. So wherever you're listening to it, hello. We have not recorded for a few weeks, so it's nice to be back with you, Michael. Even though the listeners will have been listening to us last week from the future, because we haven't recorded that one yet.
So this week we are covering Hammer into Anvil, but we have a guest number three.
Hello, I'm Alistair, online as Mr. Alistair or Conrad Slater on Twitter. So I'm from Jersey.
Now, originally we decided to cast a big net out and say, does anyone want to talk about a specific episode of The Prisoner specifically? And I've not used the word specifically too many times there, but you know what I mean. And you chose this one. Can you tell me why?
It is easily my favourite episode. This whole series has got amazing moments in it, but overall, this kind of got everything I want from this series. It sort of ticks all the boxes. And even watching it the other day, I haven't watched it for a few years, just thinking, I remember this being the best one. And I watched it and I was like, yes, this has got a lot going for it. There's some really nice things going on here. So it could be it just appeals to my narrative temperament, or I don't know, it just seems to have just tick the box for me.
Oh, that's nice. Right. We always ask similar questions at the beginning of our number threes. And one of them is, how did you first come across The Prisoner?
It was the Channel 4 in the 90s. I was my mid-teens, so I was a good age to watch it. And I think they did that show. They did Girl Who Would Be Deaf as like a one-off thing, and they got good ratings, so they decided to run the whole series on Channel 4. It was a midweek thing. I think I was at school. I think I was doing my GCSEs. So I loved it. Yes, and that was that wait of once a week. It was a good time. Because there wasn't much going on at the time in the mid-90s, was there? You know, Doctor Who had finished. My program had finished. So to have a show that did new things late at night was fabulous.
You weren't into Star Trek in the mid-90s then?
Well, that was tea time viewing, wasn't it? That was on at 6 o'clock on BBC Two.
Yeah.
So it was, I don't know, there was
so
a certain...
Approximately the same age as me. So let me see. Channel 4 late night, which means I'm predicting that you watched Max Headroom as well at the same time.
Yes.
Channel 4 started showing that about 11 o'clock at night. And I remember going in for my ear levels and being massively, let's use the word, told off by the teacher for almost falling asleep. And that's because I think they'd shown two episodes of Max Headroom back to back. And there was no way I wasn't going to watch it. So, yeah, it was The Prisoner, Max Headroom. There was Channel 4, the sort of sweet spot of the 90s, where they would also show old, really old 50s sci-fi as well, which is where I developed my love for that as well.
I had good fortune to meet one of the main editors of Max Headroom, you know, video editors. Mm-hmm. So he told me all about, you know, the equipment they used and how they were pushing it and some of the cheats and the stutter loops. And I thought that was fascinating. He was really cool. He was like meeting Han Solo. So, you know, he was a lecturer when I was at film school. So, he just came in as a guest. No, Max Headroom was fascinating, wasn't it? Imagine if Doctor Who had gone that way. You know, if you think of like, especially their pilot episode with McCoy, if that next one had been like sort of shot in film with bonfires and tower blocks. It was a funny series, Max Headroom.
It was. We're talking the live action one, not just the bit where you didn't.
Well, I suppose I'm
videos.
Sort of. Yeah, I'm sort of to catch all, aren't I? I'm talking about both in a way. I should be.
Yeah, well, yeah,
about
definitely. One,
but yeah, there was that sort of that. Remember, Beavis and Butthead had the same thing. It was there was the cartoon, there was the series, but then interspersed with that was them just talking to the camera about music videos.
Well, again, it's just Channel 4 was just a brilliant place to watch all of this stuff. But
absolutely,
yeah, we watched The Prisoner. We did love it.
Yeah. See, this Luke, is a whole thing we've talked about this on the podcast before because we've had other guests who for whom the Channel 4 in the 90s was the thing. But obviously, I was a little bit younger, and it passed me by until later in the 90s on VHS. So this is a whole kind of mystery to me. Early 90s Channel 4 late night, but it seems to have been it seems to have been a sweet spot for some people, kind of discovering the show, and hopefully, our podcast will be the catalyst for a few more people to to find it.
Well,
if you're joining us on episode 10, then
and you're a man in your late 40s.
I think that's a thought actually. Since we last recorded, I turned 50.
Oh, you did? Yeah,
I did.
Happy birthday!
Yeah. Thank you. Let me see. It was such a good time for watching great TV. Let me see. So let's get back on track. We're going to discuss Hammer and Anvil. It's your favorite.
But before we go do on. That, as you say, we do have a couple more questions about.
Yeah, go on,
about The Prisoner.
My memory is not what it was.
I mean, we generally ask why you enjoy it. So you said that the girl who was deaf was a kind of. As far as Channel 4 went, where they started and then they kind of repeated. What was it about The Prisoner that grabbed you?
I do definitely think that I hadn't seen anything like that before. There was a lot of, like, Lost. Remember, there was a lot more questions than there were answers. And so you sort of got, I've got to keep watching this to see what this is all about. How's this going to resolve? It's a curious thing. A few years later, I joined the Prisoner fan club, and so I don't know if it's still going, but again, the magazine they sent, the stuff they sent, I was like, this is not like fandom. It was very different. I can't, you know, understate how different The Prisoner is to other TV shows, how fandom is different. It was much more cerebral, much more like a game of chess, and and it wasn't sci-fi, really, was it? It's not sci-fi. It's not magical fantasy or magical realism. It is something else again. And this episode specifically is about psychology. It's about how he's basically spy tricks or something, and how he uses that psychological warfare to drive Number Two mad and paranoia. And that could be easily transposed into, you know, a Shakespearean setting, into a modern setting, whatever, those ideas. But they've just been neatly slapped in into our scenario of the village and his, you know, his imprisonment.
Cool.
Well, I guess ridiculously well summed up, so I'm just a bit speechless. Let's...
I suppose the final question before we dive into the episode is... You've already alluded to this, Alistair. There are a lot of questions and very few answers. Mm. Broadly speaking, how do you understand The Prisoner? How do you interpret The Prisoner? Do you come down anywhere definitively as to what it's all about? Or, tell us a little bit about how you interpret the show as a whole.
Okay, so I don't think there was a novelization once. First word, first line, Drake did this. And I'm like, hang on, no. So there's this previous show he did, Danger Man, and so this book said that this was the main character from Danger Man gets sent to the village. But they're quite different characters. So this person, an unknown, we never know his name, Number Six, was seemingly a spy, and he gets removed. And do we assume it's our government? Do we assume it's the enemy? I'm inclined to assume it's our government or a section of our government. It seems quite British. I know it's meant to be continental, but just the sort of the way they're doing it seems quite British. But yes, shady, shady underhand activities. And I think it is of this earth. The remake they did not that long ago with was it wasn't on Earth, it was in someone's dream. And so I'm not buying out this version is someone's dream. I think it is where it is. So I think it was an island surrounded by mountains. So I don't think there's any magic going on there. Where else are we?
Even though that there are potentially, depending on how you read it, three different episodes that reveal the village to be in three different places on the planet.
Okay.
So how do you reconcile the inconsistencies in that,
I think,
example?
Overall, the arc of the character is as they try and break him, they're using more and more extremes. And this is a combination of hallucinogens, torture and other psychological tortures, and just more, and to the point that those extremes they take are just so ridiculous, from a brain transplant. It's just so ridiculously, and apparently technology, high tech, cutting edge secret technology, and they're doing that. So I think this sort of milieu of madness is the result for these inconsistencies. A combination of madness and high technology, and maybe an unreliable witness, an unreliable, whose point of view is this told from? I think that's unreliable as well.
Cool. I like it.
Okay.
So Michael has been, whilst we've been doing this, reading along with a book by the director Alex Cox.
Oh, I want to read that.
Who has a very particular view.
Yes.
Where does he take us this episode, Michael?
Oh, right. It's bizarre, the end, because he always finishes each chapter with, so where are we at now with working out who the prisoner is? And in this one, even he admits this is the one that leads on first glance that he's a spy. However, it also implies, because Alex Cox is really trying to wangle his theory on this one, is that he's not a very good spy, because he's using fairly standard, like, non-great spy tricks. Like, we establish he's a bombardier in one of the end episodes, because he has those images of himself, you know, flying the plane. So that's how he would know Morse code. The rest of it is so improvised that he's not using real spy craft in that sense. So is he just using what he thinks might be spy craft or not? But then even Mark Stein's like, no, he definitely was Drake. He definitely was this person. And that's why he's using all of this spy stuff to mess with the guy's head.
Yes. Yeah.
So I mean,
He's deliberately doing stuff that he knows is going to get found out. That's kind of the whole point of the episode,
yeah,
isn't it?
Because
number two's supposed to think that he's doing clever things, but actually he's doing really obvious things because he knows that he's being spied on. So
yes, also, I mean, he could have learned that by reading an Ian Fleming book.
So Alistair, Alex Cox's opinion is that actually number six was a rocket scientist.
Yeah. He's an engineer.
He's an engineer based on the line in Tramps of Big Ben where he's asked, "What do you want to do? What's your dream?" "I want to be the first man on the moon." And rather than take that as a joke, which it clearly is a joke, Alex Cox takes that literally.
Yeah, he was basically working for the British Rocket Group, so you could have a Quatermass crossover if you really wanted to push it.
Wow!
And that's why number one might or might not be a rocket.
Yes. Well, I'm a huge fan of Alex Cox and his films. I used to love Movie Drive. I mean, he's a wonderful man. And I can only, in his defense, from what you've just said, say he's having fun there. He's playing with it, which is...
It's a fun book.
Series. It is a fun series. So, but it's difficult, isn't it, to pin down, to give it proper analysis, because... if you start looking at all the facts, you break it down as evidence, it doesn't hold up.
Yeah.
It's really flimsy and inconsistent. And that is fun.
So I guess to go back to the question, what you said at the beginning, that this is your favourite episode of the series because it has all the things in it that you want.
Yeah.
So what is it? Take us through the bits of Hammer into Anvil that really float your boat, as it were.
Oh, I love the he plays a record over and over, and it's like one of them has got the secret message. And one of the copies, and I thought that was a fascinating idea. That was new as a 16-year-old as well. There's one hidden there, and it's hidden in plain sight. Only he can hear it. There's something there. There's something in repetition, in iteration, and a thing which you can't find. That's open. There's plenty for me mentally to unpack.
Music cues used all the way through the episode as well.
Yeah. Okay. So there's that. I love all the tricks. I love the fact that he's. I think he's off to go get a pigeon. This made me laugh the other day. And a truck pulls up, and a slightly balding man, who's like Jerry Davis, comes and punches him. I think that was hilarious. It's like, go and punch him.
The guys that go and beat him up, the one guy in particular, the hair just kind of sprouting out of his. It's slightly by the numbers at that point.
Like, to get beaten up every episode.
Yeah, it does feel like that's kind of like the. Well, I mean, he obviously has two. He has the punch up with those guys who bundle him into the car, and then he has the punch up with number 14 at the end. Which basically
it's as if
ruins his house.
It really does feel like he has to have specific moments of action. Even that episode where he manages to. I mean, there's whole episodes where he actually escapes, and there's still random punch ups.
Yeah,
just to kind of get the audience going, this is what we turned up for. Yes.
Yeah, it's fighting.
And I will say this is one of the drawbacks of watching on Blu-ray is because it's generally the fights are very well choreographed and very well edited. But at the same time, watching on Blu-ray, the stunt people are just that much more apparent.
Yeah.
You know, you can kind of go, okay, I can see, particularly if you're watching on a 405 line black and white telly in the 60s, which obviously a lot of people still would have been. Yeah, I can understand how you could have been fooled into thinking that was indeed Patrick McGoohan throughout. I mean, his stunt guy in particular is very, very good, but the stunt guy for number 14 is very apparent in most of those fight scenes. So while the series looks absolutely fabulous on Blu-ray, it does
Well, you have to remember that, and I'm just going to show you this. This is how I've been watching the episodes.
Gosh.
Ah.
I've had them all turned into MP4s, and I've got them all on my mobile phone, right, so that I can kind of have them on and watch them a few times in moments I get spare. So although while we're sat here talking about it, I've got the Blu-ray playing on the TV to my right, just for a bit of inspiration, so I can look up and go, oh, yeah, that's the actor who did such and such or whatever, like we often do. I've primarily been watching a DVD transfer on MP4.
On your phone?
So on my phone.
So it probably works on for you then.
Well, even then. But you know what? We're all Doctor Who fans. And I just want to say John Pertwee's wig. There's a few fight sequences that look slightly more ropey than the ones that we've got going on here.
Yeah. No, I think they're pretty good.
Regardless of a Blu-ray transfer.
Yeah.
Anyway, but to sum up my previous point, the episode, now I've had time to process as well. The first thing in the episode, number two, says, no, I'll crush you. No, I'll crush you. So he sets out his stall straight away. We're at war. Who's going to win? Have a guess. And he delivered. And so it became like, we know that by the end of this, number two will in some way have his downfall. And so we're watching how is number six gonna do it. And the thing, when you get that story, when you know what's at stake, what basically how this is gonna end, but you just wanna see how, that's always a good narrative. That's always a good way to, you know, what's he gonna do? And then we've got a list of things, and he does this, then he does that, then he does this, and it all adds up. So two becomes more and more angry, and then paranoid, and then mad, and so we just wait, and we're just watching that toad being boiled.
Yes, and he just seems to be so. I mean, Patrick Cargill plays it very well.
Brilliant.
Seems to be like from the off. You're like, oh, you haven't got a chance. You know, you're just like you play the like of all the number twos, right? There are some who you're like, actually, this guy is a real match. Or actually, in the case of like Mary Morris, for example, this person is a real match for number six in terms of like, if you don't know who's going to win out.
Yeah.
Apart from that, obviously, ultimately, number six does win out as the hero. But often the village does score points. But from the off with Patrick Cargill, like, you haven't got a chance.
Yeah.
You are not a match for number six.
He's the rubbish manager that you just, just like, get him. Get him, number six. Because I've had to work for people like that. So that's why we really root for him. You don't want to see him crushed or challenged. You just want to see him.
Yeah, no, you're rooting for him because throughout the episode, he starts sacking people who you've actually come to become quite attached
yes!
to.
Yes!
Why sack the supervisor, right?
Yes!
Okay, I know this is meant to be some sort of evil organization, but supervisor is clearly, you know the thing where they go, it's a Mitchell and Webb sketch where they go, are we the baddies, right?
Yeah.
You actually think the butler and the supervisor might go, no, we're not. It's fine. We turn up to work. We do some stuff. Sorry, on the subject of which, the supervisor and his part-time job as a podcaster. What's all that going on? It's like she's, I've forgotten her name. She's not available. I'll just do some random DJing on the side. Sorry, we're not up to that yet. I know we'll come to that, but. So sacking cast members that we actually quite have grown attached to. We might not like them, but we've grown attached to them because we recognize them. That's just weird. But yeah, that does happen. You're right. He's the crap manager. Because I was thinking that the guy from ABC, he might be about the same level of crap number two, but I think he's crap in a different way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because he's like, he gets pushed too far and gets tricked into betraying himself. This guy gets tricked into betraying himself, but only because he's a terrible bully who's terrified of his boss.
Yes. Middle managers.
It's one of the few, I feel it's one of the few episodes where the existence of like whoever is above number two is we're reminded of that frequently.
Yeah,
because most episodes, there is the question of who is number one, but most episodes, number two is the authority.
Yeah,
and keeps the authority, throughout.
Yeah,
even in the face of kind of number six having beaten them at the end potentially, but often they have the last laugh because he's still in the village. They haven't broken him, but
absolutely.
But the idea of like. As you say, A, B, and C is the other one where that red phone is a looming threat, you know, because he's like every time he puts number six into a dream and doesn't discover what's going on. There's the conversation with the superiors, and it's the same here where there's the no, I've got everything under control, until he's then weeping, cradling the phone at the end of the episode, which is just a beautiful moment. Because as you say, Alistair, you're rooting for number six to win from the moment that the episode starts, because number two reveals himself to be such a horrible person. Yeah. Like, he's not... Because a lot of the number twos that you like, you know, like Liam McKern, you quite like Liam McKern's number two.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Anton Rogers is quite a pleasant character. Darren Nesbitt, like you, in spite of the fact that he's doing something heinous, you like Darren Nesbitt. Whereas this Patrick Cargill's number two has no redeeming features whatsoever. You know, which is not to say Patrick Cargill, great actor, but his character, you're just like, well, yeah, I don't care what happens to this guy. You know,
right, and his relationship with number 14. Right, I am, because number 14, the way he looks at him and offers to off number six, it's just like, you've got to crush. That's more than a, that's just more than a crush. That is, that's an off-screen romance. If you were doing shipping back in when the prisoner was on, that you'd go, yep, that works for me, that's fine. But then he just dismisses him. Like, no, yeah. off you go. He does that to everyone. He dismisses everyone.
I think that relationship is very much one way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Unrequited.
Unrequited, I suspect. Yeah.
Well, that is, you know, right up there with most slash fiction. So yeah. That's fine.
But again, I think that's very well observed. I've seen management situations in that when rubbish managers have had quite clever deputies, beta males, and have had to put up with the brunt of their managers' behaviours. So I think, it is very well observed. These kind of guys do sort of that happens, that goes on. This is familiar.
Apparently, the author of the episodes has only got 4 TV credits to his name.
Gosh.
And he was a poet.
Hmm.
He was like a left-wing anti-Thatcher poet who like died in the 90s.
Oh, good for him.
And he was... But that's what he's known for. So
let's find out. Do we know what else he wrote?
Well, I've not bothered looking it up yet, but I can see Luke reaching for the internet.
I'm Googling him right now. Roger Waddis is his name. British writer and humorous poet.
I just find it really impressive that, for a start, if you've not done much, you can produce something of this quality. Yeah.
Yes, it is well plotted.
Yeah, I mean...
So he wrote an episode of another 1967 series called Haunted. He wrote an episode of 1968's Armchair Theatre, and then he wrote an episode of Churchill's People.
Right.
But he clearly was not... a regular TV writer.
Because this is the episode where number 6 just doesn't even bring up escape.
No.
It's just like, nope, I'm playing this game today.
Yes, you're absolutely right, yeah.
So he's like, oh, yeah. Because his whole motivation is insular. You know that thing with the... sorry to bring it back to Doctor, where you've got the third Doctor is on Earth. The aliens come to you. The aliens were already here. You've got a mad scientist. They're your basic plots.
Yeah.
There's nothing else you can do. They're all variants on a theme. And with this, you've prisoners. I want to escape. Have you managed to escape yet? Not really. What can I try and do? And then, oh, here's a background of some mad science. So you've got those. But the escape theme's always there because he wants to prove his individuality. He's not. He's just proving that he's a better person or he's a cleverer person, depending on how you want to read it.
Yes, I think that second plot, though, is will he be broken? Will he reveal why he resigned?
Yeah.
With this, and so the fact that that plot is completely derailed straight away, and like you say, Luke, you know, he hasn't got a chance. So yeah, I saw a thing on YouTube when it was video games, American football, which had been modded so you could reduce the size of their bodies so they're just very small and puny. And then in the same way, you could, you know, make the other team very, very huge. So it was just, they just completely destroyed the weak and feeble team. And it was very appealing. So, a race, a competition, which is, you know, ridiculously out of proportion. It's that's Fox and the Hare, isn't it?
I've got a question.
It's one in which the guy who doesn't have a chance doesn't realise he doesn't have a chance.
Yes, that's what it is. Yes.
There's a level of self deception.
Yeah.
Going on there. Go ahead, Michael. What was your question?
It's really boring, but because that's a good way of selling this show. Right. The beginning of the episode, you've got number 2 being awful to number 73.
Yes.
Right. Now, how does number 6 even know who number 73 is?
I'm not sure that
or
he
have
does.
Any idea why, because the whole thing is you'll pay for that. Pay for what? There's no build-up. It's like there's an assumed relationship.
Mm.
And after you've watched the episode, you're like, yeah, he's getting revenge for that. But then after you've watched it a couple of times, you go, he's getting revenge for what? He didn't see what was going on. He doesn't know.
I mean, he heard her screams. And he knows this is the village hospital.
Yeah.
Right.
And he sees He sees what happens. He sees her jump out of the window.
Yeah, but he doesn't know that she's... Because his friend, Cobb, gone out the window. You know, it's are they only innocent if they kill themselves? Is that the thinking behind it? I mean, obviously, I am overthinking it. You know, that's kind of really... You know, that's why we're here.
I've generally taken it to be... maybe this number two has been in the village for some time.
Right.
And number six already has a handle on his character.
Like this is a straw that breaks the back kind of thing.
And then he's like, he sees that this is what he's like. He sees that he's driven a fellow prisoner to her death.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, that, like, 'cause you were saying before, like, it's depending on how you feel about what number six does, whether it's just he's clever or whether he's trying to make some kind of moral point, like he is avenging her death, you know.
He's running an experiment as well.
Yes.
Can I get rid of a number two quite quickly?
Yeah.
Oh, and obviously he succeeds. But equally, yeah, you could go down that route, Michael, and say, okay, there's off-screen stuff that happens where he has a friendship with number 73. We know that there are people that he develops friendships with within the village.
Mm. We know she's quite new as well.
Yeah, because she's been given a number, but it's her husband thereafter,
yes,
who's gone missing. So it's almost as if he's resigned and another village has got him somewhere. So,
gosh, yeah.
So yes, he's gone, and
but they have intel on where he is, don't they?
But they've got photographs of him in a compromising position. Yeah, but then again, exactly, that's what... Well, I would say that's what we were told the Russian government would do. But you know for a fact, it's what our government would do. It's what the Americans would do. It's what all governments would do to have power over somebody else. It's just it would work if you were trying to do that with a, you know, some weird upper class twit who just got themselves into a compromising position and was terrified what the newspapers would say or something like that.
I hope they send Michael Gove to the village.
don't. We can dream. I don't know. Well, no, the thing is, we know it's been Port Marion, so we'd have to cut off all the roads as well.
For our international listeners, Michael Gove. I don't even know what his current.
No, you'll love this.
What is he?
He is the minister to find Brexit goodness.
Oh, he's the Brexit Opportunities Minister, isn't he?
The Brexit Opportunities Minister, which is the most made up, pointless. Sorry, I can't. You know what? I'm under orders not to talk about politics at work, so it's fine.
You can talk about... I mean, the prisoner touches on the political, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Maybe we could do another episode of just people who we'd like to send to the village, like Room 101.
Nice.
And then be like, which of the schemes that they try on number six would work?
There's mileage there. It's comedy mileage.
One of the things I love about this
episode.
Sorry,
I've got the whole cabinet down as number twos. Yeah. Did you see the photograph of Rees-Mogg walking down the street in his suit, and there was this very small person who might have just been a small person or a child, but they were also in a suit, and it did look like a number two and the butler. Because he had an umbrella on a big stick, and people were saying this remake of The Prisoner is terrible. And it was you've got to find the photograph. It's awful. And you know what? We have to laugh, otherwise we'll just cry.
Yes.
So getting back on.
What I would say, one of the things I love about this episode is all the little small roles. Because... Although I was thinking it's interesting, it's got quite a long cast list for a prisoner episode. There's a lot of people who are credited, but it predominantly focuses on number two. Like, there's a lot of number two as opposed to number six in this episode. But there's all these little roles of people that are clearly on the side of the village.
Yeah.
So you have the shopkeeper and you have the various kind of techie people behind the scenes. And they're all beautifully drawn little roles. like the shopkeeper who is obviously kind of prides himself on kind of persuading customers to buy certain things, and obviously number six doesn't go for the one that he wants to buy.
It's not the same shopkeeper as episode one, is it?
No, it's a different shopkeeper from episode one.
But the performance is really quite similar.
It's a similar, yeah. There's clearly like a there's clearly a very tight job description for that that role. So you have him, and then you have the scientist who has to analyze the blank sheets of paper and go back, and then the psychiatrist. I love the psychiatrist because the psychiatrist stands up to number two and is not having any of his nonsense.
Yeah. Why don't
you ask him?
Just ask him.
Yeah.
Bomb disposal team.
Yeah.
Whereas the bomb disposal book with the cuckoo clock.
As you say, the supervisor turns out to be quite easily cowable. He kind of folds in the face of, and it's, I just love all those. It's just little parts for these actors who obviously come in and do whatever their day or two in the studio or on location or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just nice to see them all do their little walk on and walk off again.
Absolutely, absolutely. But that's the thing. It is that shopping list kind of narrative. It is. Then he does this, and he does that, and then all these little bits. Yeah. Death by a thousand cuts.
I did like that number two thinks that number six is a plant in order to take him out. That's absolutely lovely, because that you were talking about the middle management thing before. That is pure middle management paranoia.
Yeah.
Like, oh no, somebody's been sent from head office. Why?
Self-importance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And the point is that so there's the whole bit where he and number 14 follow number 6 to the stone boat.
Yeah.
Now, he has all of the surveillance of the village at his disposal. He doesn't need to do that. But he's so paranoid by that point that he has to use his own, you know, like, he could easily discover that the message to number 6 is in number 6's handwriting. He could easily discover that number 6 had gone to visit the graveyard to deliberately pick a number of someone who was dead, you know?
Yeah.
There's all these things that he could do using the technology at his disposal to see through what number 6 is doing.
He's too far gone by that.
Technology, right? Number 6 goes via, phones up the operator and says, connect me to the hospital and psychiatric, right? And then he says, and he uses the oscilloscope to prove it. It's like, well, just ask the operator, because like the operator went, I'll connect you now. And they were watching him do it. Also, this proves that the village does not exist just to watch number 6. It's to watch the others as well. It's not just about number 6. He's not the center of everything, because they say up the surveillance just on number 6.
Yeah.
Like they have to up that because they're watching everyone else.
Yeah.
So that's kind of important, really, because I always like to think that the whole village really kind of existed just to take him out. Like those episodes where, Many Happy Returns, when there's nobody there.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they're all back again.
That we talked about. That was the last one we recorded. Talking of that, Alistair, what's your opinion? Because we had a long conversation with Stephen Shapansky on our last episode. Because obviously Patrick Cargill appears at the end of Many Happy Returns. Is Thorpe from Many Happy Returns the same person as the number two in this episode?
Gosh.
In your opinion.
What did Stephen say?
I think the conclusion we came to was that they were probably different people, and that it was as a result of 60s casting. We'll have him again.
Yes. Yes.
In the same way that, like, the Colin Gordon's two stints as number two are not necessarily supposed to be the same person.
Yes.
Whereas obviously Leo McKern is supposed to be the same number two when he comes back later in the...
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's common sense. Because the alternative to that is we're into Alex Cox territory. Maybe this means that, maybe this could mean that. I'm happy to I don't think there was, and it wasn't in those days, that master plan of grand narrative, and that didn't really go on, did it? So even if you'd get a cheeky joke, or let's get him back again to do that, and we'll pretend, I agree, it's just a quirk of casting.
That makes total sense.
Should we talk about Kosho?
Yes, it's either that or the pigeons. So let's talk about Kosho first. A game that apparently does not belong to Sky yet. They haven't bought the rights, so they won't be having a specific channel dedicated to Kosho just yet.
I was going to say, unlike Quidditch, which has kind of come off the page of Harry Potter, weirdly, because people obviously can't actually fly. Realistically, you could have a Kosho League. If somebody could codify the rules. It's not quite clear what the rules are.
Don't go in the water. Yeah, actually, you know what I was just saying before about it not being for Sky, right?
It's not a sport. It's a pub game.
Exactly. You've got a programme on BBC One, which was on a Saturday evening, and you've had programmes on ITV on Saturday evenings, both of which involved basically of getting from A to B and not falling in the water.
Yeah.
Right.
And bouncing over things. Yeah.
And bouncing over things. Right. Now, exactly. So maybe Kosho really has evolved because we just didn't notice. The only difference is you're not wearing long trench coats and a hat
and a helmet.
Helmet, yeah.
The weird thing for me about this one, because obviously, like you say, don't fall in the water, because that does happen the next time we see Kosho. I mean, we'll talk about that when we do It's Your Funeral. Maybe it was just my interpretation of the scene, and you can tell me your opinion on this. But the game seems to end purely because two more guys turn up to play Kosho.
Maybe that's the rules.
If somebody else comes to play, you have to leave.
It's like golf where somebody goes, "Can we play it through?" Oh, that's the end of the game for me. Thanks so much. I'm off home.
Yeah. No, I thought they came to say, "Hang on, you've broken the rules here."
Yeah. Are they the Kosho police?
Yes, absolutely. And you got to break it up, guys. This is, you're not playing in a sportsmanly like manner, as set down by the ancient rules.
You know what? In my head, I've got. Did they use the big sticks that they use on Gladiator in the other version of Kosho, or have I just put two things together?
I think you're inserting that into the
scene. I'm trying to make this into an exciting game and failure.
There is a lot more Kosho in It's Your Funeral, so as I said, we will talk about that, but we haven't yet done that episode or rewatched it recently.
But would, for the viewers, would they be watching this one first? Have they introduced it?
I don't know, because I'd have to check the original broadcast order.
Hang on.
Right.
I've got them in the other order in my book. I'm flipping back. Right. What's the episode? It's Your Funeral.
It's Your Funeral.
If we go with the DVD order, it's next.
Yes, it's the next. As far as you podcast listeners go, we'll be talking about it next week. When we will be talking about it, I do not know.
Viewers would have been seen this first.
So the broadcast order, It's Your Funeral, according to the one I've got on my spreadsheet, which I don't know where I got from, It's Your Funeral comes before. Oh, no, hang on. No, that's not right. It's Your Funeral does come the week after Hammer into Anvil. So this is the introduction to Kosho. It's very odd.
It is more like a recap, definitely.
I've been giving this episode a bit of a thought, and there's two themes that seem to be present, and they're both linked. So if you don't mind indulging me for a second, and it's all about, do you know what a number station is?
Yes.
Right.
No.
Luke? Right. Okay. Number stations are these things that conspiracy theories love to go on about, and they are real. They are a broadcast of just a series of numbers, usually being read out by someone. And people are like, what does it mean? I don't know. And they're all over the world, right? And they've been going for decades, right?
And where would one see one of these things?
Well, on Longwave, right? They're a very weird, very old school radio signal that you can pick up if you just kind of, in the middle of the night. See, now we've got digital radio. We can just press buttons. We find the station. But in the olden days, you had knobs to twiddle.
Yes.
And if you twiddled the knobs in the right way, you might come across you came across a number station. Now, there's lots of different theories, but the primary one is that, in fact, it's not the numbers that are important. It's the fact that the station exists and it's broadcasting from a specific point, and you can use those for triangulation. So the medium is the message. It's not the message itself. The message itself is just to confuse people.
Right.
Similarly to the weird number six is in this story. His his intention, his message is to just mess with number two's head.
Right.
So he's circling stuff in newspapers. And that's the message. That's the numbers in the number station. But the actual method, the thing that's important is the fact that he's just messing with somebody's head.
Right.
So there's that. And then there's the pigeon isn't the message. The message attached, the literal message attached to the pigeon isn't the message. It's the I'm messing with your head by sending this. That makes no sense.
Yeah.
So that's what's occurred to me this week about that it's similar to where the message is that. So I just needed to get that out of my head.
Yeah.
But
that'd be the same as if I send a pigeon, then get rid of him. Yeah. So it doesn't matter what it says.
It doesn't matter that there isn't somebody at the other end to receive the message because there isn't somebody miles out to see to receive this flashy, you know, mirror thing.
Yeah.
The person who's receiving the message is number two and he's standing behind me because he's seeing the fact that I'm sending this.
So, that's another clue for number two. If you stop to think about it, because I was thinking about this, it was like, I suppose number six, if number six is really trying to communicate with somebody, he doesn't necessarily know that his pigeon hasn't got through. But there's a sort of thing of like, well, if the pigeon hasn't got through, then there's no point sending the message with the mirror because the person who's supposed to be picking the message up hasn't had the pigeon message. And if number two actually thought that through and be like, oh, anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, though, does it? He could just write the number four on the beat.
He can do whatever. It doesn't... Yeah.
Just follow the pigeon. Send up Dick Dastardly and they'll be fine. Yeah. So,
Shoot it down.
Shoot the pigeon.
I do like the fact that they tranquilize the pigeon. Like, the pigeon is still clearly alive when they bring it in.
Yes.
You know, they're not, they may be kind of like evil brainwashing.
Apparently, on Blu-ray,
little monsters.
The note does look different.
Does it?
From the one that it's written.
I haven't.
It goes from felt tip pen to ballpoint pen, but I think people just,
have to look that up.
Yeah.
I mean, I also like the fact that, like, he goes to the coding room and he goes, right, decode this message, right? And he doesn't even hand them the physical bit of paper. They just read the numbers, right? And they just read these eight numbers into the computer and then the computer comes out with a thing. And you're like, really? Like, that's not really how code breaking works. Like,
it's a very good computer.
Like, there could be like any number of things that those numbers could stand for, you know?
Yes, right. It's just something. But also, the other numbers does nothing.
Yeah.
No, there's no code. It's just blank. Yeah.
But I like how the episode kind of, and this is that you were saying that he was a poet. I hadn't realized he was a poet, but obviously you've got the allusions to Goethe. Mm. You've got the quote from Don Quixote that he puts into the paper. You've got Patty Cake Baker's Man. You've got all of these things that he's kind of inserting into the episode.
Yeah, it's kind of a literary episode, really.
Yes.
Because you don't get a lot of people going around. I mean, I'd never even heard of Goethe, right? I'll be honest.
No.
It does. The way he reacts, though, the way number six reacts is like, well, I know what that means in German because I can speak German. But the guy just says, I see you know you're Goethe. And I can speak German. That's probably about it. And I can figure it out what you're saying because many of the words sound very similar.
Yes, but you must be Anvil or Hammer. It sounds very similar in German, it turns out.
I don't know. I don't know anything about Goethe. I'll look it up in my big book of philosophy at some point.
Johann, I think his first name was, I believe. Okay. I don't think I'm plucking that name randomly out of the air, but I might be.
You might be. We'll look it up. Do you know what? If only there was some sort of massive internet where we could look things up. I'll probably do that later.
We could look up Goethe.
Could. But the Don Quixote reference I do like because, you know, it's just nice. And the fact that the writer would have gone, oh yeah, I know a quote about villages that we can use. That...
Yeah.
Because you don't have to look at, I suppose you might have a book of, you know, popular quotes. But,
what ranked by subject matter? But like, I'm looking for all the quotes about villages.
That such a thing existed. It was like a thesaurus. Yeah, it was. I think my grandma used to have one. I used to thumb through it for hours. It was fantastic.
Pearl's, cool. Pearl's Cyclopedia?
Something like, yes, that's ringing a bell. Yes, I am very, very old. Okay.
Remember the past.
I'm just going to have a scan through my notes because I think we've covered quite
Luke,
a lot.
Can we do Doctor Who actor?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Go for it.
We are kind of coming to the end. Yes. So the weekly task is yeah. And this is the thing. I've been terrible at kind of telling our guests in advance that we're going to do this. Mm. So I spring it on them at the start of the episode. So we have one Doctor Who actor this week.
I thought we had two.
You can tell me if you think you've got two, because it might be that my researches are not comprehensive. But there's one, yeah. And I spotted him.
The guest can go first, though.
Yes, but yeah, okay.
Well, I'm wrong. I know I'm wrong. But the butler's never been Doctor Who.
Oh yeah, okay. No, so the butler is taken as red. We did the butler in episode one, because he's in every episode. Yes. So Angelo Muscat aside,
okay,
who was a Chumbly in Galaxy Four.
Yeah. Who's that? Look, I thought
it was
something bigger. Okay.
Yes, it was a Chumbly in Galaxy 4. Yes. Angelo Muscat aside, because he's in every episode, so we've covered him.
No, that was my only guess.
Who is the one person in this episode who has also been in Doctor Who?
Well, who is the bomb disposal man? Is it him?
No.
Right.
Oh.
Michael is scratching his head.
No, hang on, right.
I'll give you two clues. Mm. He's playing a very different character from the character he played in Doctor Who. And the character he plays in Doctor Who is in a story that is almost entirely missing. There are a few sensor clips involving this actor because...
So Fury from the Deep.
Yes, correct, yes.
So who are the two ones there then? Mr. Quinn and Mr...
It's not Oak and Quill, no.
Okay.
It's a character who's much more prominent in Fury from the Deep, at least in terms
of
like
drawing
speaking.
Looks very much like him in the animation.
Yes.
Because I was sat watching this going, I know your face. I know your face.
Yes. Yes. So have you got it then, Michael?
I know him, but you go for it.
So it's the bandmaster, played by Victor Madden, who was Robson in Fury from the Deep. I mean, it's contemporaneous with this. Furious from the Deep was broadcast in 68. So obviously a very kind of belligerent character in Doctor Who, whereas here he's just this kind of mild. He's just a mild mannered conductor of a band who nonetheless doesn't take any of Number Two's nonsense. But again, it's one of those little parts where he didn't say anything else. He came up and asked for the particular music and then walked off, and he refuses to be carried. It's a very nice kind of little performance. But
so have I seen him in something else? Because he has got a familiar face.
Yeah, he really has.
Yeah, I don't know. You'd have to kind of look through his credits, but he's our Doctor Who actor of the week.
Right. So the one I thought was a Doctor Who actor.
Go ahead.
Was the woman working in the kiosk who gets the Cassavetes quote?
Yeah,
she's got such a recognisable face.
She seemed very familiar, and she's one of these actors that I don't think was in much.
But on the Blu-ray, on the screen, the bottom, it just says she was in Compact, which I've never seen. I mean, everyone was in that.
Everyone was in Compact. I thought, oh, maybe she's familiar, but no.
I just couldn't believe that she wasn't in Doctor Who. She just looked so familiar. It was like, oh my God, I must have known her when she was older or something. And
yeah,
that's who I thought it was. So I was very wrong.
Let me just look her up again, because I did look her up again the other day. One sad thing to point out, which I again learned from my research, is so Hilary Heath, who played number 73.
Yeah.
Was one of the first victims of COVID, because she died in April 2020.
Oh.
At the age of 70-something. But, yeah, complications from COVID-19. So very early in the pandemic, she died.
Victor Madden, I'll just quickly jump in. I would probably know him from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh, of course, he's in Chitty Chitty. Yes, yes. So Margot Andrew, who's the kiosk... girl. She was in 30 episodes of Compact, you're right. Mm. And did various other kind of ITV shows, but nothing after 1973 as well. Right. So she clearly had a brief kind of career through the 60s, and she seemed familiar, but again, I couldn't identify anything that she might have been in. So there you have it.
So I always finish with the same phrase. So does Luke want to say goodbye before I finish?
I will say thank you for joining us, Alistair, and be seeing you.
Seeing you.
Be seeing you.